From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
This past week marked the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Geneva Accords. This month, Poland presides over the UN Security Council, and the country's foreign minister, Jacek Czaputowicz, held a press conference at the UN on Tuesday.
Good afternoon. Today I chaired the meeting of the United Nations Security Council. We discussed challenges related to implementation of international humanitarian law. The meeting took place to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the Geneva Conventions, falling yesterday. I'd like to thank German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas for his participation and important contribution to the debate. I'd like to underline that strengthening international humanitarian law is one of Poland's priorities in the Security Council during our 2 years term as non-permanent member of the Security Council. President of International Committee of Red Cross, Peter Maurer, participated in today's discussion. Poland has close relations with the committee. We have agreement, we cooperate, and we appreciate the role committee played in guaranteeing observance of humanitarian law. Today's briefing followed the open debate on children in armed conflict we held on August the 2nd. It is our shared priority and common responsibility to demand improvement in the situation of civilians. The focus of today's briefing was on factors influencing the effectiveness of the international humanitarian law in the context of changing specificity of modern armed conflicts. And these factors include violation of humanitarian law by states and non-state actors, such as terrorism groups, changing nature of armed conflicts due to mainly development of new technology like drones, legal gaps in international humanitarian law, and also assuring greater accountability for violating of international humanitarian law. Today's discussion revealed that international humanitarian law is not sufficiently observed, particularly in such places like Syria, Libya, South Sudan, or Ukrainian Donbass. So very timely debate, important subjects, and I think that the Security Council will deal in the future with this issue.
Mr. Minister, as you know, a lot of foreign policy takes place on Twitter these days. And on Thursday, the U.S. ambassador in Poland, Mrs. Mosbacher, tweeted that Poland meets its 2% GDP spending obligation to NATO, but that Germany does not. And she said the U.S. would welcome these troops in Germany to come to Poland. And I'm wondering if that Poland is ready to consider welcoming 34,000 U.S. troops to Poland. Is that something you consider doing?
We cooperate with the United States. Indeed, in June, the agreement between two countries was signed. We agreed to strengthen American military presence in Poland. It is very important for the security of Poland and the security of our region. But we are talking about 1,000 American soldiers more, increase from 4,500 to 5,500 in near future. We appreciate American military troops in Germany. It contributes to our security of Europe, security of NATO, and we do not see here any direct relations between spending and movement on troops. But at the same time, we think that efficiency of American presence in Warsaw due to threat perceptions and threats coming from the East is more effective than maybe in a western part of Europe. So This is also a military aspect, assessment where these troops would be more efficient performing their role, which is deterrence and defense in case of the need.
So does Poland feel a particular threat? Do you feel a particular threat from Russia in this case? Is that what you're saying?
We are talking about a longer historical period. Indeed, after invasion first of on Georgia, then on Ukraine, there is a threat, growing threat in European Union and reaction, and also in NATO, and the reaction of that were very important decisions taken by NATO. Part of these decisions were taken at the NATO summit in Warsaw in 2016. So it is not something could be characterized by, but general assessment of the role of Russia, which is shared by the alliance, and we are part of the alliance. We agree with these decisions.
Mr. Minister, thank you. Edith Lederer from the Associated Press. Two questions. First, on the U.S. call for European countries to join the operation that they're conducting in the Strait of Hormuz, accompanying ships to ensure freedom of navigation. What is Poland's position on that? And secondly, Pakistan has asked for the Security Council to be briefed on the situation in Kashmir following India's latest action. Is this something that Poland supports as president of the Security Council this month?
As far as the first question is concerned, there are consultations are going on between the U.S., but also within a group of countries from the European Union, mainly the U.K., which raised that issue in Europe, how we can strengthen freedom of navigation. You asked that question. From our perspective, the law of the sea must be observed, freedom of navigation must be guaranteed, and we consult, as Poland is concerned, that issue. Probably it would be a good step to take responsibility by international community for that issue. And if the decision is taken, we are ready to contribute. It is premature to say in what form, but we understand the reason behind the American and the British request concerning that issue. Today I met also with Minister, German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas before the briefing, and we discussed among other issues that issue. There is a discussion going on also within the European Union, how we should organize ourselves in order to properly answer that needs. There is maybe an idea discussed that European, so to say, answer should be welcomed. In our opinion, we should rather try to join forces with the U.S. than to organize something separately from our most important ally within NATO, which is the U.S. and the U.K. So we are at the moment discussing how to answer that and face that challenge. As far as your second question is concerned, indeed, I had a phone conversation with the ministers of foreign affairs of India and of Pakistan just last days. We expressed concern over current tensions between India and Pakistan resulting from the proposed change status of Jammu and Kashmir. Poland believes that the dispute can only be resolved by peaceful means, and here We fully support the reaction of the European Union and statement issued by the Federica Mogherini. We are in favor of dialogue between Pakistan and India to sort out differences. As a non-permanent member of the Security Council, Poland stands ready, if needed, to engage in preventing actions impacting security situation. We hope that both countries can work out a mutually beneficial solution bilaterally. Strait relations between India and Pakistan negatively affect the whole South Asia region and may lead to serious political, security and economic consequences. Indeed, today in the morning I was informed, just informed, that Security Council received the letter from the ambassador of Pakistan. I think that the Security Council will discuss that issue and take proper decision. Please.
Hi there. Thank you so much for our minister. You've just been addressing the Security Council on the Geneva Conventions and how they're not being followed so well 70 years after they were created. But if you could pick, for example, one crisis in the world at the moment where you and Poland believes that war crimes are being committed and they need to be investigated and prosecuted, which conflict, which situation, which hotspot would you choose right now?
So they are... Okay, there are very serious conflicts. It's one part of the issue, so I would name them like Syria and Yemen, probably. Many victims of that conflict. Another issue is accountability, which was also in your questions, how you classify that crimes. And yes, so maybe I think Syria and the regime definitely use chemical weapons and should be held accountable, if I may choose only one conflict as an example.
My question, George Tichy from Ukrainian news agency Ukrinform. Ukrainian war is now in its sixth year, and there were attempts to hold another ceasefire in the beginning of August. It doesn't hold already, so it was violated. How do you see the way forward out of this stalemate? Is there any way forward?
Ukraine is our neighbor. We have very close relations. I discussed that issue with the foreign ministers, previous one, Mr. Klimkin, but also with the President Zelensky. I met once, twice, and also Polish President discussed the issue. So we support efforts of President to stabilize the situation, to introduce peace to Donbas, to these territories. We know that reaction is not very optimistic for the moment. For us, it is a crucial issue. We've been in the Security Council since January last year. In May, we had first presidency. And that time, I remember, I chaired the meeting on Ukraine, particularly on Ukraine, humanitarian situation then. Many countries took provided information, assessed the situation. The civilians were killed, and there is a very tragic situation of civilian population. We know the projects of president of the new administration to improve standard of living, the borderline and in Donbas and on that side of the line. So we support that. Indeed, even we raised the or proposed to use some other instruments available. One of them would be to establish a special envoy of Secretary General of United Nations to follow what's going on in Donbas, in Ukraine, and to inform international community. There are such an envoy to other regions. Why not to Ukraine? It was not... so to say, welcome, accepted. But we are, I think, in a moment that we have to concentrate and cooperate together and try to find a solution in order to stop that conflict, to look for other maybe institutions, formats. I am aware of the proposal of the president to enlarge Normandy format, for example, to invite the US and UK I think that maybe it's a good way, a good path to follow. In other words, we have to do more. We break this consensus, this stalemate, and look for other maybe institutional solutions. European Union should be more involved as well, but it is the subject of the discussion within the European Union. We do it. Poland always has been supporting Ukraine, its independence, territorial integrity, and we will continue that.
When will the Security Council meet to discuss the letter from Pakistan regarding Kashmir?
I don't know. Simply, we got I got an information about the letter. We'll see. But of course, we work permanently, and the ambassador is always here, and probably she will start consultations soon. Okay. Thank you.
The U.S. siege against Venezuela continues. Black Alliance for Peace member Netfa Freeman recently returned from Venezuela and spoke with Black Agenda Report's Glenn Ford.
A delegation from the Black Alliance for Peace recently returned from Venezuela, where they were honored for helping protect the Venezuelan embassy in Washington from being handed over to supporters of Juan Guaido, right-wing politician that was handpicked as president by the Trump administration. Netfa Freeman was part of the Black Alliance for Peace delegation.
We met with a lot of grassroots organizations and actually projects, we should say people's projects, what they call people's communes. And what they wanted, one, was to for us to be able to see what they're doing on the ground and contrary to U.S. propaganda against the country, but also to express their gratitude for what we did in terms of the embassy. Every place we went, they expressed gratitude for people protecting the embassy, which they saw as a defense of the country. And then people should understand who don't know, you know, if you're not familiar, the embassies in various countries constitute the sovereign territory of that country. So when the United States was saying they were going to put in their selection of a Venezuelan president in the body of this person, Juan Guaido, who wasn't elected in Venezuela, didn't even run in the elections. When they were going to put him in, they were actually in the embassy and his entourage or cohorts, they were actually in violation of the sovereignty of Venezuela. And so what we were doing, there was people who actually occupied the embassy and kept people out. And those of us who were on the outside demonstrating and protecting against the right-wing extremists and also trying to get food and supplies to the people who were inside the embassy while the police were trying to keep us all apart.
Yes, one would think that most Venezuelans would be indignant at the violation of their sovereignty.
Yeah, at least when you go to Venezuela, when we were there, everywhere we went, and I think that we met and were able to see a very cross-section of the country, not really the elite class, but black and brown working class people were all indignant at that violation. The only ones that you see that were not are the right wing minority oligarchy class that is actually primarily here in the United States. There's some in Venezuela too, but we didn't really come into that, and they're not a majority at all by any stretch of the imagination. And then some people who might even be opposed to or have issues with the Maduro government also would close ranks with those who are in support of the Maduro government because they don't support U.S. aggression and U.S. imperialism taking over their country.
Now, you met with people who were involved in cooperative enterprises from way back here in the United States. I wonder how those enterprises can keep going when Venezuela has been so effectively sanctioned and cut off from much of its former trading partners by the United States.
Well, they are having difficulty going on, but I think the people in those communes see no other choice but to increase their cooperation and their ingenuity in terms of keeping them going. And they, unlike the United States, where, you know, you have things going here, but with no support whatsoever from the state, unlike here, the government supports them. So actually, there are programs and stipulations in their constitution that make way for the economic and other material support of the people's communes and the people's projects like Barrio Adentro, which is to establish the healthcare clinics and healthcare facilities around the country. And we went to one place where this community built their own apartment complex. This is a cement, fully equipped apartment complex. I remember how many stories, there were like 10 stories, maybe higher. And the people actually built it themselves. Of course, it was completed when we got there, and they showed us everything. They had a bakery and a child care center and a health clinic inside, and it's a commune. So they actually cooperate in how they do things in the country. But then what was a real treat was that after we saw all this and they took us around and showed us even an urban garden that they had, they were able to see for the first time, as well as us seeing for the first time, a documentary that tracked their construction of their habitat. And so we were able to see them on film, and they were able to see themselves for the first time laying the cement and, you know, building things, and actually also even preceding that when they actually were struggling to acquire the land through legal process and legal means. And so that was very interesting to see. And on the film, they also showed them figuring out how they were going to cooperate with each other, things like how gossip is corrosive to their unity and why, how they need to keep that in check, different things like that. It was very interesting to see such a grassroots project.
You sound like you're talking about people with a relatively high level of morale.
Oh, yes. I mean, they expressed over and over again, it's almost everywhere we went, but particularly in the communes, and we're talking about Black and brown working class people, Black people, and then people who are distinctly like phenotypically Indigenous American or African. And the women are leading it, right? And then when they were talked to us with such passion and clarity about what their project is about and the gratitude they expressed for us, and then them saying, we're not defending it. I'm kind of paraphrasing, wanting to quote the sister because it was very moving. She's like, we're not defending a box. We're not defending an apartment. We're defending our, now I can't remember the word she used, but it pretty much meant, it was pretty much was the same as saying self-determination, whatever she, the words that she used, and the passion in which she spoke and the clarity. And it was very, for them, it's like, it's their dignity that they're defending as well as their survival is how they see it.
Sounds like you were inspired.
Oh, yeah. Not just me, all of our people. And I think when we look at what we're seeing here within the United States, austerity, economic oppression, and the political repression that we face in our communities through mass incarceration and the police coming down on us and those kind of things, criminalization of things and children and all that. When we see there, and then we also see as a byproduct of that repression and economic anxieties, our own people turning on each other, you know, the intercommunal violence that we face there, it's like the opposite. And it's supported by the state, the projects that they have. So what we see, there's no way to not be inspired, because what we see is an example of what's possible in the United States and actually what's needed in what we face here. So one of the things we also met, and if you don't mind, I want to say we also were able to meet with the president, Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, just the Embassy Protection Collective, just meeting with him. And one of the things he said, which I found interesting and I thought about, was he talked about the revival of the Monroe Doctrine and anti-communism. I mean, I wasn't just talking about the context of Venezuela, but just in general, he's using it and saying it was very clear that it's more than just the Trump administration, but just what the United States is doing. And so what I saw that as, really, he's talking about white supremacy and the class struggle, the acute nature of where that's going right now, and that what Venezuela is facing is a mirror, and Venezuela and other countries, is the foreign policy that mirrors the domestic agenda that we're facing here in the United States. While some of us will say, and there was a slight difference between those of us who are representing the Black Alliance for Peace and the other people in the delegation, no, all respect, all due respect to them, but in terms of how it was approached, they were very much standing up against the indiscretions of their government and my government, and we should be, we have a different relationship. You know, they're saying that they have a responsibility because they're Americans. Our position is that that's our people, African, Afro-Venezuelans, and the people who would be, and working class Black and brown people who would be most adversely affected by the policies are our people. That's who we identify with. We don't identify with the ruling class, white supremacist, patriarchal system and capitalist system that's here and the class that benefits from it. Our interests are aligned with the masses of people around the world that we share in terms of heritage and culture and class and race and those kind of things. And so that was one of the reasons that we went, was to make those kind of connections, which we also had a chance to do. And that's why we have to stand up against U.S. policy toward Venezuela and other places, because we're actually standing up for ourselves when we do it.
And you also attended the Sao Paulo Forum, which most people in the United States have never heard of. So explain what the Sao Paulo Forum is.
So the Sao Paulo Forum, it originated in Brazil, in Sao Paulo, Brazil. It's a conference of various Latin American movements and radical leftist organizations that's coming together to assert their interests and, you know, kind of realize and share information and build connections with each other. And so it's been taking place periodically. And this year it was taking place in Venezuela. It's adopted the name Sao Paulo Forum because where it was originated in Brazil and has kept that name, and but goes to the various countries. Obviously, because it's an international forum, it's heavily, mostly Latin America, and it's designed around creating solidarity with Latin American movements and organizations, but obviously also other people from other places of the world, from other hemispheres come. And so we were participating in that. Just before the Sao Paulo Forum happened, the non-aligned meeting happened just before we were there in Venezuela. So it was very fitting that the governments, the non-aligned movement with the governments that are trying to stand up to U.S. and European hegemony met. And then right after the Sao Paulo Forum, you have with the grassroots organizations and movements meeting and trying to assert and understand our own agenda. So it was a very interesting time to be there. And when we went there again, not just the Venezuelan people, but the Sao Paulo Forum has people from all around. When the delegation would walk in, they announced that we were there, and people gave the delegation of embassy protection collective standing ovations. So unlike in the United States, where we didn't get any real news coverage at all, or particularly if there was any news coverage, any clarity of what that was about, it's the opposite around the world. People around the world understand certain things, they get better information, and they have a dignity and impression about things that is completely different than what's crafted in the United States.
However, getting to and from Venezuela these days is difficult.
Oh, yeah. And this was the Trump administration's addition to the Obama sanctions, which discouraged direct flights to Venezuela. So right now, there's no way for people to travel directly from the United States to Venezuela. So when we went there, we had to go first to El Salvador, San Salvador, then to Panama City, and then to Venezuela. And what, because of the closing of the embassies and the consulates, you also can't get a visa to go to Venezuela right now, and vice versa. So people, Venezuelans can't just get a visa where you would normally get a visa. You can't do that. So you have to go to another country, and that means you have to exit the airport and then get to the embassy there and then get a visa and then get back in the airport and then go along your way. Now, for us, they tried to make it a little easier for us, but it still wasn't very easy by issuing what they called a courtesy visa to us to help us try to not have to get out of the embassy and everything. And then we got our visa once we were there. They issued us a visa once there. But that's not what everyone can do, you know, so it makes it very difficult. And then people have to understand that this affects other conditions in a country when business people or people with certain trades or anything or government people can't travel directly, then it impedes the type of transactions that need to happen for governments of the world and for people of the world to cooperate.
And now you're back, and I'm sure you're going to report to the rest of the Black Alliance for Peace about your mission. What's the key point that you would want to hammer home?
Well, one, that we think that it is incumbent on Black working class people to take a stand against the sanctions, the U.S. government sanctions, and not just, I don't want to say just sanctions, just aggressions in general against Venezuela. And we should also be trying to educate ourselves about the blatant contradictions and hypocrisy that go on while people in Haiti and Honduras are suffering the effects of U.S. policy, are up in arms. The media and the policymakers, particularly the people running for office, and also the ones who are being lifted up now as the most progressive, are not talking about the gangster draconian measures that are being leveled against Venezuela, helping us understand the contradictions. So we have to teach ourselves, we have to build our movement and stand up against it, and then we have to also see it as tantamount to the domestic repression that we face here, and that know that the government that a lot of people call their own is the biggest threat to peace, security, and the planet right now in any other place. And so we should be able to see through any lies that they tell us and know that our struggle goes beyond Republican or Democratic administration. And it has to be about us building a grassroots movement on the ground that knows how to build our survival and our cooperation and then make international connections with those doing the same.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.